This is episode 747 of the AWS podcast, released on November 24th, 2025.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AWS podcast. I'm Lish here with you. Great to have you back, and I'm joined by a very special guest. I'm joined by Byron Cook, who is a vice president and distinguished scientist here at AWS. G'day, Byron. How are you going?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. So you are back. We've had you on the podcast a couple of times years ago now, and
yeah.
It was long overdue to have you back because, as is the case with many scientific advancements, the uses are not always evident to the general populace. But right. As technology changes, stuff happens. So obviously we're going to talk about Gen AI because you can't not. But first, let's talk about your specific domain, which is automated reasoning, because it is a fascinating domain. Not many people know about it when I speak to customers about the concept. So let's maybe just briefly unpack that, and then we'll get into the utility side. So tell us about automated reasoning and why you're so interested in it.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the past, we would have talked about the story would have started in the 70s or 80s about people attempting to prove programs. And you know, we were talking about practical applications, microprocessor. I got my start in microprocessor verification, worked on reasoning about genetic regulatory pathways, reasoning about railway switching systems, reasoning about operating systems. And then at Amazon, reasoning about policies and virtualization and networking and cryptography and storage and all that kind of stuff. But actually, the story goes way back. So, Turing actually wrote one of the first papers in the space. It's called how to prove a large routine, or you know, how to check a large routine. But he shows basically how to take a program, essentially map it into the program semantics, the world of mathematics, that, you know, like mathematical logic, and then to reason about the mathematical artifact that the program is actually really representing. And we basically use the same tricks today. But then a really interesting thing happened is that with the invention of the digital computer, people right away began to think, well, like, you know, what about like artificial brains? And so the term artificial intelligence was coined at this workshop at Dartmouth. It was John McCarthy, I think, hosted it. And they invited folks from kind of different disciplines, from cognitive sciences, logic, you name it, statistics, information theory. Claude Shannon was there, and they coined that term, artificial intelligence. And so if you had talked to people in the 60s and asked them what is artificial intelligence, it's actually highly likely you would have heard about my area, automated reasoning.
Interesting.
So it's the manipulation of symbols in a logic system to try and deduce, and so the sort of running competition battle or collaboration, if you will, has actually been in these different areas where you have a sort of statistical, like a views based on cognitive science on your neurons and so on. And then views like based on Bayes' theorem, for example, and then views based on mathematical logic. And at various points along the way, the different approaches have been ahead or behind.
And I guess they excel at different things too. Like they've got different strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the things that happened is there was this notion of AI winters. So basically funding, there was a big pendulum swinging back and forth. Like there was tons of funding, there was no funding, there was tons of funding, there was no funding. And so what happened in time is that these different researchers got sort of more and more specific about the exact problem they were taking on with their tools. And so the areas kind of diverged. And so, machine learning. So, you know, later we would call those tools like machine learning, automated reasoning. And so automated reasoning became the kind of domain of like, how do we reason about programs as opposed to how do we like think about, you know, the reproducing, you know, artificial general intelligence.
Yeah, sort of an analogy of human thought. And it's interesting because if you think about why this is relevant and why you've been working on this within Amazon for so long as well, is we do things at like huge scale, like like it's difficult for a lot of folks to understand the scale that we get to operate at, and it's a real privilege to be able to do that. But when you get to that sort of scale, it's kind of beyond anyone's purview to figure out, well, how do you know this will work? Like, how do you know unexpected things won't happen? And this is where this discipline, I think, really comes into it, that this is not about guessing or assuming or it's sometimes okay. Like, this is about will this happen or will this not happen type delineation.
Yeah, there's like, at the top of my mind, there's sort of three trend lines that drove the adoption of automated reasoning at Amazon. And then, you know, I'm sure we'll end up talking about it, but then how it becomes neurosymbolic AI and how that connects to Gen AI to agentic AI. But three big drivers, pre the general public getting super excited about generative AI, the big drivers were, one, there's actually a very radical increase in the capabilities of the most, one of the most foundational automated reasoning technologies. It's called propositional satisfiability solving. So there's an international competition of the tools, and the tools are getting better and better and better, like remarkably so. And there's some real breakthroughs going out there. There's a real breakthrough like around 1999, but then there's some huge breakthroughs like 10 years ago. And so those tools are just getting better and better. So if you encode your problems into the tool formats these tools can handle, they're way better able to solve them now than they were before. So that's one trend. The other trend, another trend is that this move to a services model and the view that software is not shrink-wrapped, it's operated. And so that drives a different economies of scale situation where you basically are constantly, you're encouraged to constantly rewrite the code. Right. So we write some software, we deploy it, we take technical debt. We know that the software probably isn't going to be able to scale to where we think it might go, but we wait, that we see how customers are using it, and then we're constantly rewriting that. And so that opens up the desire for the teams to then want to replace code, or to, they're constantly rebuilding the code in that. So that's an entry point for the formal, as opposed to other places I've worked where it's like they wrote it perfectly the first time, it was their opinion. And so you kind of, yeah, like, right, it's real hard to go and like
get them to like,
yeah, exactly. And then the third thing is that with the move to the cloud, a bunch of conservative security obsessed customers were looked at the economics and they liked it a lot, but they were nervous about security. And that this work became the reason they would come, that they were actually excited to get off their New Jersey data centers, say, right? So they wanted to move to AWS, A, because of the cost, but they're like, oh wow, if you can. So we had customers say, you know, we'll move orders of magnitude workload over more to AWS if you can prove the correctness of the cryptography. That's super meaningful to us. That's a threat model that we're really worried about. And so basically it drove a bunch of business into AWS. And so I'd say those three things were the perfect storm. And I was just kind of really lucky, right place, right time when I joined Amazon.
Well, it's interesting too that, you know, often highly complex, detailed areas of research like this that are shifting all the time, often the jump into the practical side is quite difficult. And what's been interesting to me is to see automated reasoning sort of dip its toe in the water a little bit within AWS, but suddenly it's like it's available in the hands of every AWS user. So if you're, talking about provable security, you know, if you're using different capabilities, like, you know, trying to understand, you know, what can access my VPC, et cetera, like you've managed to surface this capability in a consumable form, really. Like our customers get to use this every day, sort of unconsciously.
Yeah, my frustration is that we're not really even giving them the half of it, right? Like, The problem we have is that automated reasoning is a little bit of a misnomer, because there's actually a spectrum. So some tools are actually push button fully automated, but traditionally the scope of the problems they can solve were rather limited. And so that's what you have with IAM Access Analyzer and VPC Reachability Analyzer, for example. They're based on propositional satisfiability and its cousin called satisfiability modulo theories. It's a slight extension to it. And those they have pretty significant limitations about what you can do. If you're willing to, traditionally, if you're willing to put a PhD or a person with a PhD at the keyboard to run these tools, then you could do tremendously more because now they could guide the tool to do really remarkable things. And the challenge has been that there aren't that many people able to drive that, don't have the background, they're hard to manage. You know, just a whole bunch of reasons that it's reasons. Exactly. And so that's where, we've been dreaming for a long time about these sort of, I mean, in today's lingo, I would say it this way, that language models that are trained over proofs, right? Such that now the language models can run the automated reasoning tools, or I might call them theorem provers, mechanical theorem provers. That was a dream we had. And we were thinking about how to do that, like, you know, training over all of our papers and archive and that kind of stuff. But what magically happened was that the mathematics community got really into the Lean theorem prover. Lean was founded and the sort of the main architect is Leo DeMora, who works at Amazon. So the world of mathematics embraced Lean when they're communicating with each other about their proofs, but also it allows people not at the top universities to learn the foundations of mathematics. But Lean caused people at scale to write down the foundations of mathematics, and that became really good training data for language models. And the language models began to get really good at running Lean. And so it's actually DeepMind, DeepSeek, just a whole bunch of model providers are actually using Lean, like with reinforcement learning, for example, to build models. And so for that reason, the models are usually pretty good at running these theorem provers. And so that gives us now that
radical capability that you didn't have before. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a really exciting piece of the puzzle. So that's kind of changing how we're thinking about a lot of things right now.
That's fascinating. It's an interesting, like I said, it's an interesting side effect of the general development of this sort of domain, that it's sort of picked up this capability.
Yeah. And there's the idea of the world model, right? But if you think about it, like what that's giving you is more real data as opposed to human author data, right? And the view is that author, like the volume of human author data is actually fairly limited and also flawed. The thing about a theorem prover is the data is not flawed, and it actually gives you an infinite amount of data. There are an infinite number of statements you can make and prove or disprove with a theorem prover. And so that becomes incredible training data. And what we're seeing and what a lot of model providers are finding is that if you use these kinds of tools, that you get transfer, like they are more logical. They're more able to do good recipe design. They're more able to do the sorts of tasks that use the same part of your brain that you would use when you're trying to drive a mathematical proof through.
So it's leaning on that mental model, if you like, or approach to problem solving for other things. Yeah. Meaning it's better at the other things.
What we found is that basically the Lean theorem, there are others, there's Isabel, there's Hall Light. Actually, all of the founders of those tools all work at Amazon these days. But in the world of neurosymbolic AI, or the world of where you like train models, or reason reinforcement learning, or there's various other ways of integrating these things, that Lean is kind of the lingua franca of that world. And so that's pretty exciting.
That's really cool. That's really cool. And so let's we've been skating around a little bit. Let's jump right in. So obviously generative AI happened. It brought great utility and great capability. And then folks started noticing that it would give you confidently incorrect answers, aka hallucinations.
Yep.
And so then there became the challenge of, well, I'm getting answers. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. How do I know? How do I prove or verify? And so a lot of work's gone on in terms of applying automated reasoning checks through things like Bedrock guardrails, et cetera. Talk to us about how, with the lens of automated reasoning, we can think about the data or the answers produced by large language models and how we seek to actually verify truth and incorrectness and hallucinations.
Sure. I think it's worth pointing out the two times that, I mean, we're both Amazon employees, so like, right, you'll appreciate this, and then hopefully the listener can kind of understand what we're saying, that Amazon, unlike other companies I've worked at, has like all these mechanisms to drive connection to the customer. And to me, before I joined Amazon, that sounded kind of corny. But what I've found is that actually is a big driver for why automated reasoning is successful, right? You in 2014, 15 timeframe, it was the financial services institutions in New York. I happen to be in New York and London. So customers began, like, they had mathematical backgrounds, they had the need, and they began driving on it, and were driving on it hard. And some very influential financial services institutions began to approach other financial services institutions and say to them, we need to support this, and we need to help Amazon understand how valuable this work is that's brewing inside the company. And that same thing happened actually with Hallucination and GenAI.
Interesting.
So when GenAI happened, it was kind of, the board members of most enterprise organizations' granddaughter showed them and then they began playing with it over the holiday break. And then by February, each C-suite leader of every enterprise organization needed to know what their GenAI plan was. And so then they all, diverted resources and then formed teams and went and did a bunch of stuff. And I began to get calls. And again, I'm in New York City and London. So like the financial services and a bunch of those sort of the industries in these areas up and down Sixth Avenue were calling me. And so then my calendar was filling with meetings with customers, and I was kind of hearing the same thing around, but we won't be able to, we can't trust this. We can't use it. Like the prototypes are cool. But like there were issues around privacy, issues around sovereignty, and then issues around incorrectness due to hallucination. And so those kind of became the bunch of stuff that scientists, including myself, began tackling. So to kind of answer your question directly, how I think about it, So we're sort of delving in the area of neurosymbolic AI. So it's sort of the intersection. So then with much help from my friends, who are more on the statistical machine learning side, jointly with them, I've begun to appreciate that there's like multiple ways you can combine these tools. So one is you can use automated reasoning to generate data that you might train over, and that would include reinforcement learning. Another way is to just allow the GenAI to do whatever it wants. And then when it's done doing whatever it wants, whatever magic it's using, then take that information and then prove or disprove its correctness. And then another way is to integrate them more deeply. So like in the inference step to provide hooks for logical reasoning. And then sort of a cousin to that is with, agentic tools, where you provide agentic access to the formal reasoning tools, and then it's a multi-agent system. They collaborate, and then maybe the theorem prover provides a verification result together with a certificate that audit to make sure that the theorem prover was really called, and that isn't that your other agents are just hallucinating that answer. So those are sort of different ways, and you're kind of seeing and then when it comes to agentic AI, then you have questions around, well, what are the agents doing, and how do we know they're doing the right thing, and then how do we know that we're doing the right thing? And then can we plan over the compositions? And so there's a whole kind of rich area. And what we're seeing within Amazon, and I can't really speak to all the products that'll come out, but I can speak to automated reasoning checks and Bedrock guardrails, is there's different sort of points in that space, and there's different solutions we can put together. And we're basically sort of using all of them.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's not one solution. It's lots of insertion points. Let's maybe unpack one accessible example, if I could put it that way, for folks. So one of the examples we often talk about is like a generative AI solution that's doing mortgage approval type work. So it's assessing different stuff. The question is always, well, how do I know it's right? Now, mortgage approvals is good because there's lots and lots of rules, but the challenge is there's lots and lots of rules. So how does automated reasoning go from, there's a whole bunch of financial institution policies around lending, to is my answer correct? Like, help us bridge that gap.
Yeah. So the the statement, I could make a statement that anyone who's worked in a formal reasoning for any length of time would agree with violently, but people who haven't would be super puzzled by. And that statement is that over 80% of the work is figuring out what it is you want to prove.
Yeah, start with most easy. Pareto principle lives across the world on everything.
So I'll give you some examples, you know, pre-Gen AI, right? So we launched IMSS Analyzer, right? It's a tool, automatically takes all your policies, throws them in a big soup, is able to reason at the semantic level about them, is able to prove properties. And then IMSS Analyzer walks you through an exercise to basically trick you into writing the specification, right? It is asking you a set of questions and basically building something that we're going to now prove of your system. And if ever your system diverts from that spec, then we're going to flag it to you. And then we're going to ask you, is that okay? And then the spec evolves. But also, what are the semantics of the IAM policy language? Where are they precisely? And that turned out to be a multi-year effort.
Wow. How hard could it be?
Turns out that no one really knew. It turns out these days, if you ask questions hard enough of AWS, what's going to happen is they're finally going to pull out someone from the IAM-XS Analyzer team who has a background in mathematical logic, who's then going to be answered. Because who owns it these days are those folks. And so we see that where increasingly people build on that semantics. We're building, like within AWS, we use that semantics for a lot of other purposes beyond IAM-XS Analyzer. And sometimes when teams break the semantics, they're required to roll back the changes. So it actually becomes a very important
again another guardrail of
customers. Yeah. This is the semantics. Same thing with EC2 networking. Same story. Years. Arguing many meetings, many people in the meeting. I've worked on device drivers. I've worked on biological systems. I've worked on railways and so on. It's always the same that you get three biologists. Who are working on models of leukemia or cancer, you can't get agreement between the three of them, right? So it actually turns out just what are the ground rules? What are the assumptions that we're making when we do this proof? And then what are the important properties? Like, is it all data at rest? Okay, imagine all data at rest must be encrypted. Sounds reasonable. Okay, well, what do you mean by encryption? Do you mean like a Caesar cipher? Oh, no. Caesar ciphers, that's totally insecure. Okay, but you just said all data at rest.
You said encryption.
It's encryption. So you didn't really mean, when you said encryption, you actually meant something else, right? And so that refinement loop takes a really long time. And so that's now what, you know, your customers who are going to try and do mortgage approvals or Family Medical Leave Act or, you know, questions about airline ticket returns policies or HR rules around leave of absence and stuff like that. And how does your stock interact with your leave of absence and so on? Turns out that it's really hard to work that out. It's really hard to figure out all the corner cases. It's hard to get agreement. And often achieving agreement often becomes very controversial because when you're setting policy ahead of time, you're actually making an infinite set of decisions all at the same time.
Yes.
And people begin to find all the corner cases that they don't like the answers to. And so it's very hard to reach
a consensus.
And so we're giving customers a big stick and helping them poke the wasp's nest of what is truth. And it's actually a very difficult challenge. Add to that the fact that because they don't understand, the average customer won't understand mathematical logic, and we don't want to require that they do. We're basically having to maintain a logical twin. Basically, we want to maintain a natural language representation of your rules together with the actual symbolic logical view. And it might be that we want to take the logical view and communicate it to you in natural language, but it might be that we want to take your natural language and convert it into logic, but I appreciate that you don't understand logic, and then help you understand what's hidden in that logic. And what are all the weird corner cases? And so we can kind of zoom into all the techniques that we developed for automated reasoning checks, but they're super interesting. And then what we're finding all around the company is that we're realizing that those are actually basic building blocks, and we're reusing those a lot of those capabilities in different parts of the company. And so it's a very, very exciting time right now. Let me say it that way.
It is. So if I'm then a customer, let's keep let's keep picking away at this mortgage approval situation. So if I'm a customer, I'm using automated reasoning checks in guardrails, for example. So I can upload, I'll have documents, I'll have policies, et cetera. Is automated reasoning basically interpreting that and converting that into that mathematical model for me? Is it playing back maybe if it's detecting anomalies or as you say, often these policies are built over time and they actually have built in clashes with one another because they've never been applied to this. Like, what do you see in terms of that process from a customer standpoint?
There are a lot of things we could do and probably we will end up doing, but at the first launch there, we're doing something more limited. So what we're doing is we're taking in PDFs and we are automatically synthesizing our first swing at what we believe the policy might be in a formalism. It's called SMT, satisfiability modular theories. So you have logical constants and you have axioms, basically. And then we axiomatize a representation of what we believe the document to be saying. We use generative AI to help us do that. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, whoa, like you're trying to mitigate hallucination in generative AI. And that same challenge is going to come up when we talk about inference time checks. So keep me honest to explain that to you too. Right. So we use generative AI to help formulate. And so then now how do we help you get confidence that it's right? Okay. Well, what we can do is we have a logical formula with propositional structure, like ands and ors and nots and so on. So we can walk that structure and find interesting corner cases embedded in the logical structure. And then we can find examples in those, like we can find like the sort of convex holes, to use a technical term, but the sort of different slices, if you will, of the formula. And then we can find exact witnesses of those formulae. And then we can translate them into natural language. And then we can say to you, hey, what would you think about this case? Thumbs up, thumbs down. And if you say thumbs down, then we're going to say, well, why not? And then you're going to give us a bit of text. And then we use that text to take another round at the prompting. And then we're using a technique from IMXS Analyzer. So basically IMXS Analyzer is doing the same thing. We take all of your policies and then we look at all of the like weird corner cases that sort of are up to the parts of your policy. We basically take your policies, put them in a blender, and then get a whole bunch of like interesting scenarios out of them and then run them by you to say, what about this? What about this? But then we use some techniques from lattice theory to reduce the number of questions we're going to ask you. And it's something analogous to like green eggs and ham, like the Dr. Seuss story, right? Like if you've already said you don't need green eggs and ham, you don't need them in a car and on a bar, at a bar or whatever, right? So we're able to like
scoping down very quickly.
We basically use some those kinds of tricks to reduce the overhead of that exercise, but it's not trivial. Like, right. And so there's a bunch of science going on now about how to make that exercise easier and easier to understand. And then we can lock that down. And then there's a bunch of things you could do, right? So you could deploy this in production and then you could record your customers' Q&As, for example.
Yes. Yes.
And then if you make a change to your policy later, you could go replay those with automated reasoning checks again to see how the rules change and how you give different answers. And then you can also collect customer feedback on the questions, on the answers that they didn't think were right, or you could audit them. And then you use that information to figure out which of the rules you actually have got wrong and sort of make an organizational level decision, like, do we want to change the rule? Do we not want to change the rule? And it's my hope and belief that in time, that we will no longer use PDFs to decide policies, right? That we will, that the real source of truth will be mathematical logic, and that people of the future probably won't understand mathematical logic per se, but they will have natural language
abstraction.
Versions, representations of those, and that they, because of tricks that we have with generative AI, that distance between those two things becomes much smaller.
I think that's what the interesting thing is, because we want to get it down to that representation that benefits the ability to process, but without the PhD.
we have another trick that's very clever. And then there's a whole bunch of science going on about how to do it even better. But
I love Byron, this is like the use of your phrase trick. When what you're really saying is highly detailed, incredibly complex, amazing, interesting mathematical work that's being done, aka trick.
What we do is we can do this both at the time when we're translating your documents, but also at inference time, right? So imagine you are now an airline customer and you're asking a chatbot, or we could talk about how this translates to agent, you know, SOPs and agentic AI and so on, but it's kind of the same question. So the customer is asking a question. How do we map that to mathematical logic at inference time, right? Because now we don't have the benefit of the like, oh, pump the brakes. Let's walk you through a bunch of examples, right?
This is real time.
Exactly. Grandma wants to know if she can change her ticket from a first class to a coach ticket, and it's a code share flight, and it's, you know, the multiple airlines involved, and she wants to know now, and you can't say, we're going to like walk you through a semantics exercise. So how do we do that? Well, we actually translate multiple times. So you can take the same thing and you can use different language models. You can use different settings of the language models, all kinds of things you can do to basically exercise out the ambiguity in the statement. So if the statement is unambiguous, very often what we see is that we get semantically the same formula. They can be different syntactically, but they're equivalent semantically. And if there is ambiguity in the statement, we tend to get different formulae. And so what we can do now, so we basically imagine we get five translations, each from different language models or the same language model, but like just call different times. And then we use the theorem prover, you know, automated reasoning, to check that each of the pairs are equivalent.
Mm.
And if they are, then we're very confident we got the translation right. And if we don't, we get a counterexample. Right. So the one translation may assume it's first class. One of the translations may assume you've taken the flight, and the other translation may assume you didn't take the flight. And so now we get to go back and we get to ask the customer or the customer's customer, right? Either the airline or the passenger.
Yeah.
Did you mean you've taken the flight or have you not taken the flight?
So we seek to solve for that ambiguity that has emerged, that's evident.
Yeah. And so brings up all kinds of really interesting cognitive stuff, which I'm talking to a lot to cognitive psychologists and so on. And so there's a whole thing about theory of mind and around how people build mental models about what each other understands, and they convey information in ways that's efficient, but leverages the shared mental model. And so basically what's happening is at inference time, we are trying to build literally a logical representation of the mental model that the customer has or the customer's customer quickly. And then to such that we can now reason about that formally and then provide evidence as to why the answer is correct. So that's turned out to be very interesting work.
And it's interesting if I sort of, just as we come towards the end of the episode here, I'm thinking that throughout what we've been talking about, a lot of it has come down to bringing the capabilities and the sophistication of automated reasoning, the complexity, if you like, to a level that can be accessible to non-specialist people, that can be accessed by systems, etc. There's kind of this ability to introduce it to more use cases, because as you said at the start, you don't need the PhD necessarily sitting there all the time. This sounds like it's likely to actually create a kind of phase of hypergrowth in the use of this technology and the advancement of this. Like, this is really interesting to me that suddenly it's just going to explode into.
So here's the fascinating bit, right? Your SMT or SAT solvers, they're NP complete typically. So that's intractably large, right? That's the famous hard, you know, the hard problems. But those are the easy ones by our
that's breakfast.
Like NP complete is practically boring, because for us, the hard problems are the undecidable ones, right?
Mm.
So there are, practically speaking, whether or not it's NP complete or undecidable, what that really means is that the tools will from time to time not be able to answer the question. They can answer, they can be correct. They can say the theorem is not true or the theorem is true, and you can rely on those answers. But sometimes they will just either never come back with an answer, or they'll just come back and say, I don't know. So that is a natural consequence of NP complete or undecidable problems. That's a fundamental computer science, you know, intro to the theory of computer science 101 kind of idea.
It's there.
And the challenge is that it's fundamental. So you the only way to deal with it is to get as close as you can to the customer to appreciate the type of problem they're asking, because you're trying to statistically cause that case, those cases, you want those cases to be so few that the customer still benefits from using the tool. And so it's a very interesting, good UX and design and customer connection and formal reasoning are comorbid. Right? They live together.
They live together.
Yeah.
It's true. It's interesting. I think more folks are getting familiar with that concept somewhat unconsciously, because if you think about, you know, folks using these tools in their daily lives, most people know that if you kind of, you know, do a broad one-shot statement to your, you know, your chatbot of choice, you're going to get a pretty questionable answer, versus if you take the time to think about your domain, think about your scope, think about what you want the tool to do, you'll typically get a much higher quality answer. This is kind of speaking that same thing of scope down, and then suddenly good stuff happens.
It is amazing to watch our society discover how hard it is to get to truth in complex domains.
Yeah.
And I think we're discovering that as a society. And I'm, by the way, I am in my personal life, right? Like I abstract a lot away, and so I don't appreciate how hard like the Department of Buildings in New York City is to navigate, or like, you know, like laws or electrical codes or whatever, because I just do this all the time. I don't really do anything, right? And I too am trying to use Gen AI for those things, right? Like, do I really need
this permanent or that?
Can I just do it myself? And so I'm using Gen AI. I'm like, whoa, like. Right. Now that's going to not meet code. There are all kinds of issues, right? And so the defining and reasoning over true and untrue statements and complex domains is incredibly hard. And I think that we are, as a society, really beginning to appreciate that as we're trying to remove these slow, error prone, socio-technical mechanisms we've had in place with AI systems to help us answer those questions efficiently and truthfully. We're really having to dig in as a society about what is truth and how do you encode it.
It's fascinating. I think it's exciting. Byron, thanks so much for coming on. I know your time is really short. Thank you for coming on and sharing this with us. I know a lot of our listeners are going to be like dusting off old maths books, but also relax that they don't have to.
right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing is you can, nowadays, you know, lean and a little Gen AI goes a long way.
Absolutely. There's a t-shirt right there. Lean a little AI, go a long way.
Yeah.
Thanks everyone for listening. We do love to get your feedback. AWS podcast at amazon.com is the place to send us any feedback you have. And until next time, keep on building.